September 9 marks the 50th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising and the subsequent massacre by New York State police and prison guards. The rebellion at Attica Prison, a medieval-looking place near Buffalo, New York, began on September 9, 1971, and ended 4 days later with then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller, an aspiring presidential candidate, ordering the massacre. It resulted in the most people ever killed in a civil setting in the history of the USA. The rebellion was inspiring to many around the country and around the world in that it represented a growing movement fighting for human rights for prisoners. Civil rights attorneys, many from the National Lawyers Guild, came from around the country to immediately respond to the massacre. They provided legal representation to inmates who were charged with crimes due to their involvement in the rebellion. Many of the participants, particularly key organizers, were subject to abuse and torture by the prison guards after the rebellion was suppressed. We speak today with attorney Michael Deutsch from the People's Law Office in Chicago. He, along with the late attorney Elizabeth Fink, were the main lawyers for the brothers. He represented several Attica brothers in criminal lawsuits and the brothers in a class-action civil rights lawsuit, which lasted over 20 years and settled in 1999 for $12 million. Attorney Michael Deutsch, very glad to have you on Law & Disorder. Welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Michael, how did you get involved in the Attica situation?
Well, after the massacre and the systematic brutality in rehousing the prisoners, the National Lawyers Guild put out a call for lawyers to come to Attica and help. And our office made this commitment that we were going to do that. And first, Jeff Haas and a paralegal, MZZ Webster, came. Actually, Jeff was among the first lawyers that got in after the retaking and the rehousing, and he was able to smuggle out the first statement by the Attica brothers since the rebellion. And actually, one of the prisoners, Dalu, Puerto Rican prisoner who was involved with the Young Lords Party, had put the statement in his cask because his arm was broken. And that's how he smuggled it out, and then Jeff brought it out. And after that, about 2 weeks later, Flint and I came, and Dennis then came, and then Dennis and I decided to just stay there and continue to work and help form Attica Brothers Legal Defense, and also to deal with the situation with the brothers in the lockup, but those who have been designated as leaders, they were put, X's were put on their back, and many of them were brutally beaten and tortured. In fact, the Second Circuit, United States Court of Appeals, the Second Circuit called it an orgy of brutality, and certainly they're not a progressive organization, and we'll learn later how they just destroyed the Attica brothers' rights to recovery in terms of the civil rights suit. So that's how we got involved. And for the next years, you know, I would go back and forth between Chicago and Buffalo, where we were waiting for indictments, because immediately after the massacre and retaking and rehousing, the New York State Organization on Organized Crime, which had just formed the year before, took all their resources and transferred it to investigate the crimes committed by the Attica brothers in the retaking and in the 4 days in the yard, and did no investigation of the state police or the prison guards who had carried out the massacre, who had killed on that September 13th 29 prisoners and 10 hostages were prison guards and civilian employees. They killed their own. They had no plan to retake the prison without shooting everybody. They fired 4,000 live rounds of ammunition in over six minutes. And many of the prisoners who had been shot died because they bled to death. And reason they bled to death is because after the massacre, not before, because before the massacre, they had brought an ambulance to the prison for each one of the hostages. So they had an individual ambulance for each hostage and did nothing to prepare for medical care for the prisoners. And what they did was they called after the massacre and said, oh, we have a problem here and we need some medical help. And they called Buffalo, which is about 40 minutes away, and they didn't come till 2 hours later. And by that time, 10 prisoners had bled to death. So that's a short story about the beginning of Attica, or the one phase of the Attica resistance.
Whom did you represent? What were they charged with?
Well, I was representing Vic Black, one of the head of the security rebellion, and during the negotiations, he would escort the observers. There were about 25 people who the prisoners asked to come to the prison to assist them in negotiations. And William Kunstler was one, Louis Steele, who was the president of the Lawyers Guild at that time, Herman Medill, a U.S. congressman, and many other people who were involved. Bobby Seale came, head of the Panther Party, Black Panther Party. And so I was representing Big Black, but I was also one of the staff lawyers and organizers of the Attica Brothers Legal Defense, because ultimately, a year later, they indicted 63 indictments they brought against all the prisoners and basically charged them with 1,400 felony counts, and half the indictments had a potential of life in prison. So Big Black was involved in the security, so he was charged with kidnapping, and he was also charged with, because he was head of security, three prisoners had been killed in the cell block, and he was charged with a conspiracy with other leaders to kill them. And so he was charged with conspiracy to commit murder and kidnapping.
What were the conditions like at Attica just before the rebellion? I mean, what caused the rebellion?
Well, the conditions were horrible, and for months the prisoners, they formed a group called, they call themselves the Attica Liberation Front, had been negotiating about dealing with these conditions. The medical care was atrocious. They accused the doctors of being Nazis. The parole was arbitrary. The food was terrible, all pork, when many of the brothers couldn't eat. The pay was pennies for working in the metal shop. And essentially, there was a lot of censorship of political writings and other things, and it was futile. They wouldn't change. They didn't change. The warden was a Vincent Mancusi, who was known for being brutal and racist. And, of course, all the guards were white. All the officials in the prison were white. And it was a terrible place. And the reason that the Attica's rebelled. Originally, it started out as just kind of a riot. And as soon as they got in the yard, 1,200 prisoners came into the yard. They organized themselves. They picked leadership. They had security. They took all the hostages and put them in a circle and had the Muslims guard them and make sure nobody interfered with them or threatened them, and made sure everybody got something to eat over the 4 days and were protected. So rebellion was caused ultimately by the conditions and the failure of the New York officials to deal with those conditions. And when it came down, the real issue was they were negotiating and there was some agreement as to some of the changes and some of the conditions. But the main problem was one of the demands was to get rid of the warden Mancusi, and also because one of the guards had died in the initial incident that caused the A yard, D yard, where the prisoners ultimately ended up. the door broke and everybody rushed into the D yard. So that was the story in terms of the conditions. That's what caused Attica.
What could have been done to avoid the mass shootings and the killings?
Oh, there's so many things that could have been done. As Big Black said, I thought they'd just come in and bust a lot of heads, but I had no reason to understand that they were going to come in shooting like they did. There was no reason. The prisoners were not armed. You know, they had some makeshift weapons, but hardly anything. The assault force could not have saved the lives of the hostages because there was no way they could have got to them if the prisoners were intent on doing harm to them. But the reality is that they put out this word afterwards that the hostages had their throats cut, and that's why those people on the catwalk who were shot down died. And ultimately it came out, it was a lie, that every hostage was killed by gunshots, and there was no prisoner with their neck split or died as a result of any action by the prisoners. They should have come in. The other thing was they were waiting for 4 days to come in. The state police and the prison guards, who got their own personal weapons, brought their own personal weapons and got weapons out of the prison, had been waiting around for 4 days, and all these false rumors were being perpetuated. They said Black had castrated a guard, and all these other rumors about atrocities being committed by the prisoners. So by the time they were ready to go in, they were in a racially heightened state of anger and frustration, and they went in to just kill as many people as they could. They would have went in without any firearms. They would have been able to subdue the prisoners without killing 29 prisoners and 10 of their own.
How did the criminal trials go?
The main trial, there were several trials and several acquittals, and the only major conviction was two Native American prisoners who were 21 years old, Charlie Pernasalis and Dr. Jawea John Hill, who were represented by Bill Kunstler and Ramsey Clark, the former attorney general, and they were convicted and got substantial sentences. But all the other trials were either found not guilty, or ultimately, when there was a movement for amnesty for all the prisoners who were indicted, a lot of political support for them throughout the country, and ultimately they were all given clemency by the new governor, Hugh Carey, and the two Native American brothers had their sentences commuted, so they were eligible to come out right away. So it was a victory in terms of the prisoners not being put in prison longer for what they did not do, or just, you know, asserting their human rights to be treated like, you know, human people.
We're speaking with Michael Deutsch. He was one of the central attorneys in the Attica brothers cases. Michael, please talk about the memorable people that you worked with. I'm thinking about Liz Fink, Frank Big Black Smith, Bill Kunstler.
Yeah, there were some tremendous people that were involved in support for the Attica brothers. Liz Fink was a key person in terms of the civil rights suit, and was also a solid person involved with the Attica brothers' legal defense. Bill Kunstler was, of course, the famous radical lawyer who was the spokesman for the prisoners and very present during all these meetings and organizing with the prisoners, and he was like the lawyer for the prisoners. There were so many great brothers. Roger Champin, who was a great jailhouse lawyer, beautiful guy. Richard X. Clark, very wonderful man and very articulate, and I could go on and on. Herbert X. Blyden, a Muslim leader in the prison. Akil Al-Junde, who is the main defendant in the main plaintiff in the civil rights suit. became one of the spokesmen for the Attica brothers. So there were just many brothers that were exceptional. They had come mostly from New York, and they were radicalized in many ways by the organization. Some were members of the Black Panther Party. Some were members of the Elijah Muhammad Muslims, and some were young lords. And they had a consciousness and a gravitas that had brought a lot of political consciousness to the whole Attica situation. They were making demands like passage to a non-imperialist country was one of the demands they made. And they had brought a kind of a radical sensibility to the whole Attica uprising.
After the criminal prosecutions were dealt with, you were involved in a civil class action lawsuit. Tell us about the allegations you made in that lawsuit, and why'd you bring it, and what happened?
Well, our case was essentially one of assault by the head of the state police, or the one in charge of the rebellion, the commissioner of corrections, for not dealing with the demands of the prisoners before the rebellion and just ignoring them, basically, against the warden for the torture and denial of medical care, and the assistant warden who was in charge of the rehousing of the prisoners. So those were the main defendants in the case. We brought the case because we wanted to have the brothers who had been, the families of the brothers who had been killed and those who had been tortured and denied human rights, to be able to get some compensation from the state for what they did. And what happened was, originally, the case languished because it was brought by lawyers in New York and they didn't follow up on it. And then finally, the judge sat on a motion to dismiss the civil rights, class action civil rights suit, for 4 years. You don't start discovery, I'm going to dismiss the case. So Black went to Liz, who was back in New York, and asked her to take over the case, and she contacted me and Dennis and Joe Heath, a lawyer from Syracuse who was very involved, and we agreed to be part of the civil rights suit. So we then returned to Buffalo and prepared for the suit, and began a trial in 1991, okay, 20 years after the event. One of the things that was remarkable is the judge, his name was Elfin, John Elfin, in Buffalo, federal judge in Buffalo. He was just out of it in a lot of ways. So when we started to pick a jury, he refused to ask questions about the jurors' opinion about prisoners, or whether they had any relations that worked in prisons, or if they knew people that were involved in prisons. He wouldn't ask any questions about prisons. And he was picking these jurors, like, he picked six in like an hour. And we were objecting and objecting, and finally we caucused and decided we're not going to go ahead with this case because he's making a sham out of it. So we told the judge, if you don't change these questions, we're leaving. And it was a very intense confrontation between us and the judge. And the judge backed off, essentially. And in the next scenario, the next group of jurors, he asked these questions. A lot of jurors took themselves off, or they said something that was relevant in terms of their opinion about prisoners. But the first six jurors, he had already picked, and he refused to dismiss them. So when the case came down, we were in trial for 3 months. Another interesting thing was, when the jury went out to deliberate, the judge had a planned vacation to the Barbados. So he left. And while the jury's deliberating, he's in Barbados. The jury naturally has questions, so they put up a little contraption on his bench, where he would sit normally, and he got on the telephone to answer some questions, and it was a little crazy because it didn't work and no one could hear him and he couldn't do anything. So the chief judge ordered him back to Buffalo, and he came back in the middle of the night with dark sunglasses on, and the media were there to film him, and it was like another scandal within a scandal. And then ultimately, the six jurors he picked with his own process hung the jury as to every defendant. They were all hung. They found that the denial of medical care was cruel and unusual punishment, but they didn't hold anyone responsible for it. So the only verdict that we got, which was a result of compromise between the six jurors he picked first and then the next six, which were based on asking proper questions, they hung except for a verdict against Carl Fail, who was the assistant warden, who was in charge of housing the prisoners and supervising their return to their cells. And what they did was they literally brutalized all the prisoners. They stripped them nude. They made them run through a gauntlet of guards swinging clubs and then crawl on the floor with glass strewn. And then the leadership, people who were involved in negotiations or security or had been outspoken, they put an X on their back, so they got special treatment for and brutalized specially, even taken away and put in isolation units. And then at night they would be pulled out of the cell and beaten up. So we did get a verdict against Carl Fail, which involved his failure to stop the beatings and brutality in the rehousing of the prisoners. So based on our case, it was a class action case, we then had these damage hearings, which were hearings about two representative class members who would then apply to all the class. So one case was for Big Black, this person that suffered maybe the worst type of brutality and torture, and an all-white jury gave him $4.5 million. And then we had another damage hearing for a typical prisoner, one who hadn't been taken out, put an X on their back, just had it run through the gauntlet, and was beaten as he went, was returned to his cell. And the jury gave him $75,000. So he was typical of like 1,000 prisoners. So the jury gave him $75,000. If you times that by 1,000, you get $750 million, plus Black's 4.5. There was a huge verdict, and it was going to be multi-million-dollar verdict, and there was a 4 years more delay in trying to resolve the case and get maybe make a settlement, which was basically stalling by the defense attorneys who were paid thousands and thousands of dollars. They were private attorneys getting paid at a very high rate. They weren't attorney generals. They were just, brought there to be paid and to defend and delay the case. So ultimately, there was no settlement. We went to appeal in the Second Circuit, and this goes back to the Second Circuit being a reactionary court. And basically, after all this, they said, oh, there was a problem with the jury verdict forms, and they were ambiguous, and therefore we can't give any value to the verdict of against Fail or the damages ordered by the jury. And you have to go back and start all over, and you might have to do individual claims. And this is like 24 years later, okay? And we were all volunteer lawyers, we were making $50 a week. And we didn't have the resources to go further than that, make 1,200 individual claims and individual trials. So ultimately, the Court of Appeals was somewhat embarrassed and said that a new judge should come in the case and try to resolve it. And after more delay and more hearings, we finally got an agreement because it was $8 million. The whole thing was $12 million. The lawyers got $4 million, which was spread over a bunch of different people.
Michael Deutsch, it's great to be able to talk to you about this. We're coming to an end to our allotted time. I've got one more question for you, Michael. The slogan of the Attica brothers was, "Attica is all of us." What does this mean to you?
Well, when you raise that as a possible question, I started to think about that because I really wondered about Attica doesn't affect all of us, but it impacts all of us. I think they were saying Attica impacts everyone. It impacts the prisoners, obviously. It impacts people who are fighting for justice and human rights. And it also impacts negatively on the whole prison system and those people in the general population that don't care about how prisoners are treated. So Attica impacts all of us. That would be my interpretation of what Attica's all of us means.
Thank you, Michael Deutsch. Great to have you on Law and Disorder. There's going to be a number of events in New York City to commemorate the events 50 years ago, and I'm sure you'll be part of that. And we'll check in with you later to talk some more about it. Appreciate your being on Law and Disorder, Michael Deutsch. You take it easy.